first stars have yet to be found by any experiment, of course, but the approaches that we take that I think are the most fruitful are the ones that integrate different techniques together. So just to set the stage, you know all this stuff, but we're talking about something between redshift, maybe 20 to 50 perhaps, and the end of the first stars epoch probably occurs sometime around redshift 6 or so, just as a wild guess. So we're concerned with the first billion years or so. Reionization is really the approach to these questions. Thank you very much. I'm done, that's enough. Reionization is the way I came into this field. I was thinking about issues surrounding reionization, what the first sources were, what their radiative signatures were. So this is the period we're concerned with. Just to remind you, in the common picture, the reionization of hydrogen is accomplished most likely by stars at a redshift of 6 or beyond. WMAP suggests beyond. And the reionization of helium, on which I've done some work, is thought to require the harder spectra of QSOs at redshift 3. This picture is changed somewhat by what we've learned about the first stars in the last few years. So should we go now, or? Okay, 3 minutes, I have a break. So I like to show this particularly in public talks. This always gets people's attention. This is the astronomer's periodic table of the elements, in which the area of the square is proportional to the cosmic abundance at the present day. You can see what dominates. Hydrogen, helium, this is cosmic abundance by mass. These squares are, I mean, they look like pixels here, but they're actually rigorously defined. But of course, in the early universe, we don't have any of this stuff. And it's really this aspect of the problem from which all of the other consequences that I will describe flow. All the observational signatures, all the cosmological signatures, everything that I say after right now. After the break, probably. Okay. Great.
Thank God the pizza periodic table.
Okay, so we've been through the context. We've been through the reason why all this stuff is going to occur. Now I'll show you what happens. As part of my thesis, actually, a few years ago, I calculated evolution tracks for zero metallicity stars, wrote a code of my own, asserted the metallicity was zero. And the idea behind this was just to estimate the contribution to reionization from metal-free first stars. So the zero-age main sequence for population 3, the truly metal-free stars, is in blue here. This is a standard HR diagram. I have a fiducial POP2 model in the red line at the zero-age main sequence. This comparison between POP3 to POP2 will recur through the talk. This population 2 is the lowest metallicity model from the Starburst 99 compilation, which is 10 to the minus 4 solar. So you see that the first thing you notice is that there's about a factor of 2 shift in effective temperature going from population 2 to population 3 metallicities. That is, of course, an effect of the primordial composition for a reason I'll get to in a second. These stars are also systematically small, so you imagine a metal-free sun being about 5 times smaller and very blue. Another feature I want to point out to you is that there are these three intermediate metallicities. It's a carbon mass fraction of 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7, and 10 to the minus 8, not relative to solar. These three lines are what I imagine to be, just for descriptive purposes, the second generation somewhere in there, just to see how the dependence on metallicity went. you notice that between 10 to the minus 8 carbon fraction and true metal free stars, there's actually a larger gap than between any of these other decades. So this suggests that there really is a sort of a singularity of stellar evolution. It's a very steep dependence on metallicity as you go to z equals 0. There's another grid, very fine grid, by Daniel Scherer, who dialed the knobs down on the Geneva Code and calculated models up to 500 solar masses, and we'll see in a minute why that's relevant. So it's always important to explain why the first stars, why metal-free stars are so hot. And it's actually a very simple thing to understand once you think about it in the right terms. Imagine what a star is, right, by definition. Just a ball of gas which has a certain mass and is able to support its mass against gravity by some form of energy source. That's a simple definition we all got in stellar structure course in school. But basically, you can assert a typical energy generation rate in the core that is needed for a star of a certain mass. And as it turns out, for massive stars, that typical number doesn't change much. So in this plot of energy generation rate as a function of temperature, where this is 10 to the 8 Kelvin, I've drawn a typical desired value for a massive star. And that's true of massive stars, all metallicities and most masses. So in the green curve, we have the energy generation rate as a function of temperature for the CNO process catalyzed by carbon at a mass fraction of 10 to the minus 6 in carbon. And you can see that that stellar interior will achieve the typical stellar value, or the typical required value, around 40 million degrees. However, if the star is restricted to either proton-proton burning, in other words, it has a pure hydrogen-helium composition, or to CNO burning at a very low carbon mass fraction, the shallowness of this curve, the black curve, or shifting the green curve down 5 orders of magnitude, forces the star to a very high internal temperature. Now, the way the radiative transfer works in the stellar interior, the star can only transmit its energy at a certain rate, and that basically means that a hotter core is going to be a hotter surface. So there's about a factor of 2 in here. Now, I've told you that the star is either on this curve or on this curve, and there's a detail that needs to be mentioned. Probably first stars, metal-free first stars, are not on this curve for very long, if they ever spend much time there at all. What really happens is that they find themselves on the red curve because the interiors get hot enough to burn a very small mass fraction of their helium through triple alpha burning into carbon. So let's go back up. On the upper main, you can see this bend in the main sequence right here, right about 15 solar masses, where it tends to get a little bit steeper. That's where that effect comes in. So below that mass, it really is true proton-proton burning. They're not, the interior is not hot enough to burn triple alpha. Above there, you get a gradually increasing carbon fraction at what I'm calling the zero-age main sequence, where this is about 10 to the minus 9 mass fraction carbon. So stars that we think of as being metal-free are not truly metal-free for very long. It only takes a million years or so, or less, 10 to 5 years to get up to that carbon abundance. So these features of stellar evolution have some very interesting effects on the stellar spectra. These are just population syntheses that I made with some metal-free stellar atmospheres and with the grid of evolution models that I showed you before. The key features are that the red spectra, the population 3 spectra, the blue, the black is the fiducial POP2. You see, the red spectrum is first harder. This is the Lyman limit right here. This is the helium 2 limit. Second thing you notice is that above the helium 2 edge at 4 Rydbergs, these stars, the metal-free stars, have a very, very strong gain in ionizing output. That's going to have important effects for reionization, for observing these stars, we hope. That gain is seen here in what we call the Q values, or the ionizing photon budget per second. going from population 2 to population 3, you get that 5 order of magnitude gain. This is just continuous star formation. It's another mode that we use in reionization modeling. Maybe Aparna will get to that later. So the key features here are the population 3 cluster produces about 60% more H1 ionizing photons. That's just a result of the effective temperature gain. It takes about twice as long to decline to decline to 1/10 the ZAMS value compared to POP2. So the intermediate mass stars, say from 6 to 12 solar masses, make an important contribution, whereas those masses would not make an important contribution at low redshift. And then finally, POP3 produces 10 to the 5 times more ionizing photons above the 4 Rydberg edge. Again, I want to point out this: these are the 10 to the minus 6, minus 7, and minus 8 intermediate metallicities, and you see it's a very steep function from here to here to here to here. Note especially the difference between 10 to the minus 7 and 10 to the minus 8. Now, the fact that this line is not up here is an effect of that triple alpha burning that actually brings the carbon fraction up to about 10 to the minus 9. Oh, yes. These are rigorously calculated from a population synthesis based on the tracks that I showed. So it's all in. It's a little bit shorter, maybe 80% the higher metallicity value. But you know, nothing you'd worry about on an order of magnitude calculation. So let's get to the observational signatures. Still following the train of consequences from the unusual composition, the very large ionizing photon production, especially above the 4 Rydberg edge, and the Bloor continuum combined for what we call large equivalent widths in nebula Lyman alpha. For the theorists, that means the ratio between the flux in the Lyman alpha line and the underlying continuum. Often the underlying continuum is not detected, so you end up with limits, a lower limit. So this is the equivalent width of Lyman alpha versus time for one of the population syntheses I just showed. Population 2 stars are thought to maximize their Lyman alpha equivalent widths at about 240 angstroms. Population 3, you see, this is with a saltpeter IMF from 1 to 100 solar masses, have extremely high, you know, and easily detectable high values above 800 angstroms. Again, the very strong sensitivity to intermediate metallicities. And this is interesting because when our first paper came out, Tomlinson and Scholl in 2000, Malhotra and Rhodes were just publishing the initial results of the LALA survey. And they took our spectrum, modeled the distribution of equivalent widths that they found, which had a median of 400 angstroms over 157 objects, and took that to be possible evidence that these stars had a very low metallicity. The other option was that they had a higher metallicity and a top-heavy IMF, still a viable possibility. I, right now, take this as an interesting hypothesis, but since most of the galaxies are single-line redshift detections, it's very easy to have a single-line galaxy detected with oxygen 3 or oxygen 2 or something, and so it's very hard to rule out another interpretation. As we'll see, the real signature is something else. However, this steep dependence of equivalent width on stellar metallicity suggests that if enrichment, say going from population 3 to population 2 is very rapid, should see a bimodal distribution of equivalent width. So in other words, going back to some redshift, you'd see the typical population 2 value, and then suddenly it would switch to population 3. I don't know if we'll see that or not. Just depends. More observational signatures. In this plot, I've taken the model spectra for population 3 here, population 2 in the right panel, redshifted them to redshift 5, which is now sort of a ridiculously low redshift, and shown them in observed flux space. The first thing you should notice in this plot is the presence of these emission lines due to helium 2. These are nebular emission lines from helium 2 at 1640 and 4686 angstroms. This is the stronger line at 1640. And it's a direct consequence of the very large gain in ionizing photons above 4 Rydbergs. This is going to be the truly unique signature of the first stars when they're found. This signature basically fades to nothing above around 10 to the minus 6 solar metallicity. So this is a very unique indicator. Another thing I want to point out is that in the left panel, I've got the red line. This is the stellar continuum plus nebular emission. So it includes the emission lines and continuous emission. If you take that spectrum and plot it over here in the dashed line, you see that in terms of broadband colors, the signatures of population 3 and population 2 are quite similar. They're actually strongly degenerate because the bluer spectrum adds ionizing photons, which are then replaced into the rest frame optical band as nebular emission. So there's a possibility for strong confusion. And then if you are willing to relax the IMF, the situation can get even worse. The degeneracies can be really bad. However, the helium-2 emission line signatures should remain. So just to summarize what I've said, distinct evolution because of the effective absence of carbon, very strong ionizing radiation, particularly above 4 Rydbergs, with a strong emission line signature. So if you were at the conference last week, you heard all about the importance of cooling in the early universe and the effect that has on the initial mass function or the masses of the first stars. I won't spend much time here except to point out again that below 10 to the 4 Kelvin, we're dealing exclusively with H2 cooling, which is expected to have a very large effect on the IMF. We're building up here to tests of the first star's IMF for nucleosynthesis. Now, this is a plot which I'm sure will be controversial of what we call the critical metallicity for star formation. Now, imagine that the first stars do have this unusual mass function due to the effective absence of metal line coolants while they're forming. There must be some metallicity at which the star formation becomes normal in a qualitative sense. This is work done by Fernando Santoro and Mike Shull at Colorado. There have been other studies by Brahm and Loeb did this in a very, what I consider to be a fairly simple model, but it's been done very exhaustively by Rafael and Andrea's group. Just to give you some idea of the way this works, these lines plot the critical metallicity for fragmentation, above which you get fragmentation, below which you do not get fragmentation, as a function of the initial density of the collapsing cloud. So if you include carbon, oxygen, silicon, iron, all the species, all the lines that are relevant, and no dust, that's important.
So what's the physical criterion for fragmentation?
Basically that the cloud is able to cool more rapidly than it collapses, effectively
cooling time is less, essentially,
yeah. Okay, you see that if there's no metals, above some density, fragmentation is always allowed, whereas there's this turnover, which I believe was, I don't know, did you see this turnover in your models? A high density turnover? So this is due to line quenching, by the way. Line quenching. Eventually you reach the critical density. Right.
You go to LTE.
Yeah. Right. So this is only in here to show you that there's some critical metallicity at which we expect the IMF to become normal. Below that metallicity, well, I don't know what I mean about normal, but anyway, different. Different. So you may have seen Tom Abel's talk last week in which they claimed to have put all this physics in, followed the collapse of a small halo down to stellar scales, roughly, and they found the cloud core profile with 100 solar mass gravitationally unstable, but up to 1,000 solar masses available to accrete, and with fragmentation unlikely because the H2 three-body process was inefficient. They also argue, and this will become important later that there can only be one such star in each small pre-galactic halo. That becomes relevant for nucleosynthesis. So again, gradually building up to the way the IMF works and its connection to nucleosynthesis. Another result you may have seen before from Jonathan Tan and Chris McKee, who took the end state of the Abel et al. Simulation as the beginning state of semi-analytic models, in which they followed the accretion of the gas onto this little core and included feedback of the radiation from the young star. So they identified two key processes in the feedback. First, H2 region breakout, in other words, the ionizing photons from the young star begin to exert radiation pressure and ionize the gas that's accreting, and also radiation pressure in the Lyman alpha line, which is resonantly trapped in the absence of dust. The H2 region breakout becomes, for the rotation parameter derived by the Abel et al. Simulation, H2 region breakout or ionization becomes important at around 90 solar masses. So this is the mass scale at which you'd expect to see some inhibition of the accretion. Radiation pressure in the Lyman alpha line, however, becomes important at a much lower mass of around 20 solar masses. Now, in talks and in proceedings, Tan and McKee are saying that 30 solar masses is probably the more likely value, but we're certainly somewhere in that range of 20 to 30 solar masses where feedback becomes relevant. So this is a suggestion.
Sorry, F Kepler is
F Kepler is the fraction of the Keplerian velocity at which the cloud is rotating.
The higher that is, the less pressure you need to support.
The higher that is,
the less thermal pressure.
Yes, and there's also the issue of the formation of a disk, which is an effect of this.
And that's why those curves go down.
Yeah. So this value was the value that was they derived from the Abel et al. Simulation. So, with all of these ideas in mind, both the Abel et al. Suggestion that the first star should be very massive, and the feedback results from Tan and McKee showing that there are feedback mechanisms important well below there, well below 100 solar masses, we set out to try to quantify this mass function and these processes in some way. And this is really, I guess this is the key point that I want to get across to you in this talk. So here I have a plot from Alex Hager, which shows the initial mass of a metal-free star and its final mass. In other words, this is the no mass loss line here. And he's divided the mass range up into the effects, or rather the ways the stars end their lives. So around 10 to 28 solar masses, they end as a neutron star. Above there, you get a black hole with either some fallback or some explosion and a fallback, or direct black hole formation. And then, in the very interesting ranges between 140 and 260 solar masses, this is where the stars are subject to what's called the parent stability supernovae. In other words, right after core helium burning, there is very efficient conversion of internal gas energy into electron-positron pairs, which basically means that you're creating rest mass in the star without a corresponding increase in the pressure. So now the star is too massive for its energy production. It starts to shrink, violently so, and in this mass range between 140 to 260 solar masses, there's only one violent collapse and a complete explosion. In this mass range, the stars are expected to leave no compact remnant whatsoever, nothing left behind. Here you get a black hole. Above that range, the explosion is not sufficient to prevent the star from collapsing back and forming a black hole directly. So this very distinct behavior between 140 and 260 solar masses prompted us to formulate two versions of the VMS hypothesis. The first of these is what I call the strong version, in which no stars below this very distinctive signature at 140 solar masses formed at all. In other words, the nucleosynthetic signature of the first stars should be whatever the signature of this mass range is. That's it. The weak version of the VMS hypothesis, and this is, of course, not intended to connote my views of their viability, but only to say that this one makes a stronger logical claim. In the weak version, stars with 8, right about here, to 50 solar masses, in other words, the progenitors of type 2 supernovae, formed in addition to the VMS in some unknown ratio of masses. There's no statement in here about the shape of the IMF. It's only a statement about the relative contributions to nucleosynthesis. I think this is a very important distinction to make, because not only is this range of nucleosynthesis very different from this range, but the versions can be independently tested. That's the key point. Both observationally with direct tests and with nucleosynthesis. So how will we do this? There are two approaches that are being used at present. The first, and the one I'll talk about in detail, is to use old nearby objects. In other words, this is my RDPR figure, we're saying we have massive first stars which exploded as supernovae, eventually found their products in a new star-forming cloud and formed a low-mass star which has now been incorporated into our galactic halo. The alternative, of course, is to study reionization both with the Sloan quasars and the WMAP data, and Aparna will talk about that in detail, so I'll just breeze by it. So the data set that I'm comparing to is a sample of a few dozen what are called extremely metal poor halo stars. These are stars in the galactic halo that are thought, this is the assumption anyway, to trace the earliest epochs of chemical enrichment, or rather the products of the very first supernovae. So these plots show the salient features of these EMP stars. First, going from solar metallicity, iron over H, down to around 10 to the minus 3, these stars tend to show enrichment of R process elements. This one is europium, barium is another key element that's observed, including some very high enrichments of R process elements. Alternatively, they also show iron peak abundances, cobalt to iron, nickel to iron, zinc to iron, and so on, in very well-defined ratios with a pretty tight scatter. This data is from Kroll's group. This is work with a VLT. There's similar work on almost the same sample of stars by Judith Cohen at Caltech using Keck. These features, the presence of R process abundances, presence of R process elements, and the particular ratios of iron peak elements in these EMP stars, offer us clues to what the IMF was in the first generations. The first thing I want to point out, let's go back there, is that in the parent stability supernovae, there is no production of R process elements. There is no time at which the conditions are right for the rapid growth of nuclei from the iron peak elements on up the periodic table. So automatically, very quickly, you should see that the strong version of the VMS hypothesis is excluded by the presence of the R process elements down to the very lowest metallicities. Second, we can do comparisons with the theoretical yields and the the iron peak elements, and that's what I've done here. So it's worth spending a little time here. These are the parent stability supernovae, and the theoretical yields are marked with the colored squares, and these are from the models of Hager and Woosley. The data points from the three samples, Kroll and two earlier samples done a few years ago, are in the black points. So for instance, when you have all three samples, you see 1, 2, 3 columns of data points for that element, going from carbon to zinc. Now, I've broken this down into mass range, 150 to 170, segregated by mass, to follow the suggestion from Abel et al. That each one of these stars is probably enriched by only one supernova progenitor. There can only be one star per halo, and at some level, you're only going to get one supernova enrichment event per second generation star. If that's true, then you only get to use one of these colors at a time, right? You either get a star from this mass range or this one or this one, so you can only use blue for each element, red for each element, or green. If that's true, the match is very bad. You see that if you're forced to use the intermediate mass range 185 to 205, just pick one star from that mass range, magnesium will be matched rather well, aluminum somewhat, potassium, scandium, vanadium, nickel, cobalt, very badly. 5 minutes? Okay, I'm wrapping up. Alternatively, there is a class of objects that is just becoming to be understood, I think, called hypernovae. This is something that Ken Nomoto and Hideki Yumeda have studied. These are stars with 10 to 50 solar masses. These are supernovae that originate from the progenitors of ordinary type 2 supernovae, but which have very high energies. In other words, from 10 up to 60 or so times 10 to the 51 ergs, so almost up to 10 to the 53 ergs. If these supernovae occur at zero metallicity and enrich these second stars, the match is somewhat better. And I particularly want to call your attention to zinc, where the parent stability supernovae produce either this amount of zinc relative to solar, almost 1%, or much less. The blue and red squares are way down here on the plot, whereas the hypernovae do quite a bit better job of matching zinc, and better for the iron peak elements in general.
What did the hypernovae do for the R process?
Well, the R process is complicated because no one, first of all, really knows where the R process comes from. There are several mechanisms. We know from Alex and Stan's models that nowhere in the parent stability supernovae are those conditions from the various mechanisms proposed ever met. In these objects, they definitely can be met. These are energetic type 2 supernovae. So the usual neutrino-driven winds, some people even invoke binary to explain the R process. Those processes are not excluded in any way by this mechanism.
Well, it's not a big surprise that I forgot to just mention the data well, because they've been banking with that. Suddenly they change the energy, they have one extra free parameter.
That's right.
The energy.
They do.
And for the fallback or the energy.
Right. I wouldn't go so far as to say that they've been invented just for this purpose. I mean, the energetic supernovae are seen at low redshift or inferred at low redshift. So if they occurred at the lowest metallicities, then you can get a match. The type 2 supernovae, although I don't show them in detail, just ordinary type 2 yields match quite a bit better too.
So if you had a metal and an H star with a very high energy, this would be way off.
No, I think even normal type 2 supernovae can have a fairly good fit.
Right? Yeah, a normal type 2 supernovae works reasonably well. Reasonably well. This is just a wild suggestion based on...
No, I'm lost.
Okay.
Do I need high energy, low metallicity, or basically nothing?
Okay, so type 2 supernovae do reasonably well predicting the odd-even effect that is seen in the data. The parent stability supernovae over-predict the odd-even effect dramatically. This is something Stan Woosley said. The hypernovae are needed, the energetic supernovae are needed to match the particular iron peak abundances that are seen. Ordinary type 2 supernovae do less well at that.
It does to
some extent matter because of the prior nucleosynthesis history inside the star.
Right. So Lorraine is saying zinc should not track iron.
So who's saying it?
It looks like zinc has a different origin than iron in objects like this.
No, they basically go together.
Is that both, so that you're producing iron in neutrino-driven bones?
No, that's for the R process.
But I thought that's how zinc is produced. That's what the Hoffman hypothesis was. I mean, I know they've always had trouble in reproducing zinc as
well. The neutrino-driven winds are not explicitly included in these models, as far as I know.
Exactly what you said.
No. Now, neutrino-driven winds are one of the proposed mechanisms for R process production.
Okay.
Yeah. I better move on. I just want to note in passing that there's a very famous star called HE0107-5240, which is the current grand champion of low-metallicity stars at an iron abundance of 10^-5.3. But it has enriched carbon, four orders of magnitude, enriched nitrogen, enriched oxygen. So it's not totally clear that this deserves to be called a metal poor star. It's an iron poor star. There have been models. Lemongier et al. Had a model which matched this with two different supernovae of 15 and 35 solar masses. But in order to match this star, you have to do some very fine scale tuning to the models. You have to. It's a real Goldilocks problem. They could only do it by assuming two supernovae, both of which went off very near the place where this star was formed, and had just masses tuned just so. So it's tough to say. Finally, I just want to come back to the point about observational signatures, and show you that the strong version and the weak version of the VMS hypothesis predict very different ionizing photon production in helium-2. This is ionizing efficiency, or basically the total number of ionizing photons produced by a star in its lifetime as a function of mass. You see that this only becomes significant compared to hydrogen ionization at the highest masses. So if you're talking about the strong VMS hypothesis or the weak VMS hypothesis, you should see very different helium-2 ionizing signatures, very different helium-2 recombination line fluxes. So finally, just to sum up the nucleosynthesis, cosmological simulations, of course, suggest we're going to see very massive stars only, but the strong VMS hypothesis, the one that forms only the very massive stars, seems to be excluded by the presence of R process elements at the lowest metallicities in the galactic halo stars. In a normal IMF, in a Salpeter IMF, in which the weak version is embodied, so you have high mass stars and the type 2 progenitors, the VMS dominate the iron budget. If they dominate the iron budget, they should also dominate the budget of the iron peak elements, and we see that is a poor match to the data. So at the present time, I'm arguing that there is no nucleosynthetic evidence for very massive stars in the first generation. Just to summarize the whole talk, most of this I've said. I should point out that these arguments about the mass function do not in any way represent a consensus of people who work in this field. Clearly, the theorists strongly prefer the strong version of the VMS hypothesis just because that's what their simulations tell them. Finally, as I mentioned at the very beginning, most of the results that have been obtained by our group, by basically every group working in the field, have been obtained only because we've had people who work on the lowest metallicity halo stars, observers who've been doing this for 20 years, talking to theorists who study, you know, star formation in the very early universe, all of whom are, you know, talking to people who are doing the cosmological simulations. So it's really a novel and cool and interdisciplinary field to work in for this reason. I think actually that this is an upward going trend. We're going to end up bringing in CMB, infrared background, everything you can think of probably, because it may be some time before we find the first stars directly. So we'll need to pick up every tool we can in the interim. So with that, I'll hand off to Aparna, who's going to tell us about reionization.
Imagine that you can start forming relatively low mass stars at a metallicity level of 10 to minus 6 solar. Do you expect that this will wash out the VM? I mean, this will be sufficient to wash out the signature of an earlier star, very massive star generation?
In other words, would if normal IMF occurs at 10 to the minus 6, would it be the signature of that generation that you're seeing in the extremely metal poor halo stars? That's entirely possible. At the present time, we don't have any good hard evidence that these extremely metal poor halo stars actually carry the products of the first generation. All we know is that they are the lowest metallicity stars that we can see. So under the assumption that that's all true, there you go. The critical metallicity, as you know, varies a lot depending on who you ask. So I wouldn't necessarily, right. I mean, right. I know when I ask you, I get 10 to the minus 6, but there are dust in those models, and there aren't in the ones I showed. So that makes a difference. Well, so they include, to the best of their ability, they have something like 300 nuclear theses in their reaction network. They include, to the best of their ability, rotation, all asymmetric effects in the star. There's nobody in particular who I would trust more than their models. However, they can't yet do fully three-dimensional models. They can't yet include all of the exotic processes like the neutrino-driven winds, at least in a rigorous sort of constrained fashion. So, right, to the extent that we're limited by any theory, that's one of them. That's one of them. I don't think there's any.
I'm sorry, the Hadron loosely?
Yeah.
No, I mean, using what they have, they don't produce some elements that you need, like nitrogen, but
that's right.
One element that could change quite a lot, so I should mention.
Well, that's true, that's true.
So I'm sorry, adding to what you're saying, not correcting, but
what about for the very massive stars?
For the very massive stars, because the point is that you don't have very strong winds or mass loss in these stars. But this is only due to the fact that you don't have mixing.
Well, that's true.
If you have an efficient mixing on the upper levels of the stars during the main sequence, then you can lose a considerable amount of mass and mass.
That would be very difficult to quantify, though.
No, there are some models, but I'm not sure they are.
In terms of, what level of, how do you constrain the rotation velocity? You don't. Actually, binaries are invoked as one of the ways you can get these very high carbon to iron, nitrogen to iron, and oxygen to iron ratios, because they have these scenarios where the star you're actually observing is, right, there's mass transfer. The star you're actually observing was the lower mass star in the pair. The higher mass star of, 3 to 5 solar masses originally has been through every phase in its evolution, during which time the metals get transferred to the low mass. No.
I have a very urgent, quick question. I'd like to. We have to finish by 2, so it's up to you.
Okay.
Just wondering, what are the processes of the stars in most of other galaxies?
You need to be able to do resolved spectroscopy of stars in other galaxies. But I mean, any place you can find a low metallicity star would be useful. As it turns out, the oldest stars should be in bulges and not in the halo. So it's possible we're not even looking in the right place. But that's a very difficult experiment to do. So
thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.